You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, May 4th. Support for this reading comes from the DuPaco R.F. Hofer Foundation. I'm Judy.
And Helen.
And here's our first story.
Pandemic adds challenges to serving students in special ed. Tri-State educators adapt approaches after school buildings close, but some services are difficult to replicate from a distance. Peyton Kirkenbush receives a call from his special education teacher each morning to get help to help him on track for the school day. The Potosi School District second grader fills his days with worksheets and online assignments at home and virtual meetings with teachers and classmates. Peyton has high-functioning autism, and his mom, Melissa Kirkenbush, isn't too worried about his academics, but it is tough to replace the social-emotional skills that he builds when he is at school. When we've struggled, we voiced what we are struggling with, and Peyton's teachers have adapted, Kirkenbush said. I think definitely he's getting what he needs. There are some things that school just can't replace. While school buildings have been closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, teachers have adapted their approaches to reaching students who have special education needs. Educators say they are doing their best given the circumstances, but replicating some services that special education students receive is challenging from a distance. I think we're definitely concerned about those students that we're not able to reach every day, said Kathleen Conready, special education coordinator for Holy Family Catholic Schools in Dubuque. But on the flip side of that, we are meeting with our students and we have a lot of accommodations in place. Dubuque Community School officials are providing students with voluntary enrichment activities, so special education staff are making sure their students have access to those, said Brenda Duval, the district's executive director of special education. Educators have developed accommodations to educational resources, as well as all activities that students with various needs can complete. Teachers reach out to families to help students navigate resources and to provide support to parents. Some of our families had said, "We're just not interested," or "That's not a priority," Duval said. We had some families who had family members who were sick or were dealing with a multitude of different things. But many of our families had taken special education teachers up on the opportunity. Holy Family requires its students to attend virtual classes while campuses are closed. Special education students meet virtually with their teachers twice per week, and on other days, students access resources to practice what they are learning, Conrady said. It's been going pretty well, she said. We have had pretty high attendance, and teachers are doing a great job about being flexible with their schedule. In Potosi, special education teachers and assistants reach out to elementary students pretty much daily, said Tammy Cooley, director of student services. For middle and high school, special education teachers coordinate with general education teachers to help students meet learning targets. She said her staff has been relentless in seeking to reach students, but that offering special education services remotely has been challenging. Some of our staff, they start first thing in the morning, and they're still doing calls well into the evening. So it's pretty taxing, Cooley said. This is definitely a harder way to serve kids. In East Dubuque, Illinois, the school district special education teacher Brooke Mazaros has had success with her junior high school students who come to class virtually and receive extra help. Some students have struggled without the structure of school, however. Being able to meet with them really helps, and I think that's the best thing we can do for them at the moment, Mazaros said. Maxwell Long, director of student services for Platteville, Wisconsin Schools District, said that given the conditions, his staff is doing well. However, there are challenges that come with providing special education services virtually, such as diversity of needs that students have. Students really struggle with accessing instruction in a virtual format, whether it's due to developmental level or whether it's due to severity of disability, Long said. That presents a unique challenge as well. Duval said Dubuque schools are looking at plans to get students back on track when they return to classes and to adapt special education services for students if schools have other extended closure. Nothing can replace the power of what our teachers do in the classroom, but I do think that given the circumstances, we can make plans that will support students through these crisis times. Adrian McKay's son, Kalen, is a fifth grader at Prescott Elementary School in Dubuque. Kalen has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and is academically bright, but does do better and has consistent routines and interactions with other students. McKay said Kalen's teachers have called him to check in and has offered him activities he can do and opportunities to connect virtually with peers. They're doing the best they can do reactively, but proactively, I wish they had prepared, she said. I think that this will motivate them to come up with a plan. So if, going forward, we have to do that, there would be something in place.
Fresh site for Fincells. Produce business opens at new location. Local business leaders receive national exposure. A family-owned business, famous for its locally grown produce, recently opened for the season in a new Dubuque location. Fincells Sweet Corn on Saturday unveiled a new stand outside the former Shopko building at 255 JFK Road. Frank Fincells said the stand is selling asparagus, hanging flower baskets, bedding plants, and vegetable plants. As the spring season progresses, it will add strawberries, green beans, and a variety of other items. The opening of Fincells is a familiar sign that warmer weather is arriving. The spread of COVID-19, however, could make this an atypical year. We're usually very busy when we first open for the spring, Fincells said. I am hoping that will be the case this year, but I don't know what to expect. Fincell said he explored multiple potential sites where he could open a stand this spring. He ultimately determined that the former Shopko property fit the bill. Fincell is eager to bring some activity to the location, which has been relatively quiet since Shopko closed in early 2019. The stand will be open from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. daily and eventually extend its hours to 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. The stand will be staffed by Fincell and his family members, who will be mindful of safety as they conduct business. We have leased a big open space in the parking lot that will allow us to practice safe distancing, Fincell said, and we'll all be suited up with masks and gloves on. In previous years, Fincell's Sweet Corn has operated stands outside of the Blaine's Farm and Fleet location and the Plaza 20 Shopping Center in Dubuque. Fincell plans to open the stand outside Blaine's Farm and Fleet later in the year and could resume operations at Plaza 20 as well. With the upcoming opening of a new Riverside location, a Bellevue brewery will live up to its name. Crews have started renovations on the future home of River Ridge Brewing. Co-owner Kelly Henecke said the new location at 301 South Riverview Street likely will open this summer. With a patio that puts customers right next to the water, the new location will offer an up-close view of the Mississippi River. We are in a river town and have a brewery called River Ridge, Henecke said. It seemed fitting for us to have a location by the water. Nationwide attention. A trio of local businesses appeared in a recent cable news piece detailing the economic impacts of COVID-19. A crew from CNN paid a visit to Graham's Style Store for Men and Women in downtown Dubuque on Tuesday afternoon. A portion of the interview with owner Ben Graham aired the following day. In the clip, Graham discusses how coronavirus fears decreased sales by 70% during the first half of March. Since the business was forced to close in the middle of March, Graham's Style Store has seen sales decline 95%. Graham told the Telegraph Herald that the journey of the store's founder and his great-grandfather has provided inspiration and perspective during the current challenges. He started this business in 1936 during the Great Depression, but he was tenacious and persistent and positive, and the business survived it, he said. CNN also paid a visit to Stone Cliff Winery in the Port of Dubuque, where owner Nan Smith predicted that economic activity is going to come back slowly. The crew also featured a livestock auction business in Maquoketa. Bob Larkey, the longtime owner of Maquoketa Livestock Sales Incorporated, told the cable news crew that he sold about 1,400 cattle in April, less than half his typical volume for that month. He told the Telegraph Herald that everyone across the ag economy is struggling to sell their commodities. It makes no difference if you've got cattle or corn, he said. The more you've got, the worse it is.
Local colleges deal with financial impact of the virus. School officials work on providing refunds for room and board, as well as distribution of federal relief funds. With college students' semesters disrupted by the COVID-19 pandemic, area school officials are working on financial plans related to their charges. Many local college students left campus more than a month ago as their classes moved online. The schools are working out details to get them refunds for room and board while they are not on campus. Meanwhile, school officials are also navigating how to distribute federal funds available through the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. We're going to do the right thing for our students to the best of our ability, said President Jeffrey Bullock of the University of Dubuque. The area colleges that offer student housing reported that they have elected to offer student refunds for their shortened stay in residence halls. Students with meal plans also are getting a portion of those payments refunded. We came to the determination swiftly that students would get a refund, and then it would just figure out how to do that equitably, said Ellen Carroll, Senior Vice President of Loras College in Dubuque. Loras officials are basing refunds on unused service days, prorated based on students' financial aid levels. UD officials have committed to offering room and board refunds, but they are working out the methodology to do so as they await more federal guidance, Bullock said. Each student's situation is different and we'll address each situation independently, he said. We wanted to let the guidance come out through the federal government and understand specifically if there were any ramifications due to federal money, state money, and scholarship aid. At the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, officials estimate that they are refunding students $2.7 million for housing costs and about $2.2 million for meal plans, Chancellor Dennis Shields said. College officials also based refunds on the amount of time students actually spent in residence halls and are refunding money still left on meal cards.
They also offered refunds on parking passes and offered two additional paychecks to student workers whose jobs ended because of the pandemic, though some students are still able to work from a distance, Shields said. Any disruption in pay or resources puts them in a difficult spot, so that certainly motivated our notion that we ought to get the refunds out to them as quickly as we could, Shields said.
As colleges seek to refund students for various costs, they also could have been tasked with helping distribute aid available through the CARES Act. Schools are eligible to receive CARES Act funding, but at least half of what they receive must be used for emergency aid grants for students. Clark University's total allocation has been set at about $769,000. School officials recently received the Student Emergency Fund portion of their allocation, but currently are working out how to dispense money quickly and fairly, said Beth McGrath, Vice President for Business and Finance. $385,000 sounds like a decent chunk of money, but when you split it among 1,000 students, it shrinks up pretty fast, McGrath said. So that's where we're trying to come up with a method to get it to the students that are most in need of it. Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore has been allocated about $784,000. Students who incurred expenses because of pandemic-related school disruptions can complete a short application for funds. School officials plan to set a maximum grant award of $1,300 per student. If funds remain after all applications are processed, officials will assess remaining funds and offer those up to students. With the unexpected costs they've incurred, to get that to them as soon as possible could make a huge difference, said college spokeswoman Katie Glass. Northwest Iowa Community College officials opened up applications for CARES Act grants on April 21st. In the first week, they received about 400 requests, said Randy Mashek, the college financial aid director. The school has been allocated more than $1.8 million in total. The application for funds allows students to request amounts in $100 increments, and students who request more than $1,000 are asked to give additional information. However, most requests in the first week averaged about $600 to $800, Mashek said. A lot of people, the students and their spouse, both lost their job, and they also have to watch their kids who aren't in school, and they might not have internet access or reliable internet, she said. There's a lot of different scenarios out there.
Ex-Holy Family official suspected of theft. Catholic school system says former Holy Ghost principal stole about $53,000 in 2019. Dubuque police are investigating allegations that a former Holy Family Catholic Schools administrator stole tens of thousands of dollars from the system and sold school equipment while keeping the proceeds. Court documents filed last week show that investigators served a search warrant at the home of Todd Wessels, 48, of 1330 Belmont Street, after system leaders found what they believed to be evidence of crimes that included Wessels in 2019 using his system credit card to upload about $53,000 to a PayPal account that he used for personal purchases. A review of financial records indicate Wessels was making numerous unauthorized purchases with Holy Family money for years, to include paying his Alliant Energy bill for his residence, making food purchases at grocery stores and restaurants, purchasing theater tickets, and making non-school related purchases, the search warrant application reads. Wessels, who was principal of Holy Ghost Elementary School and the system's curriculum technology director, was placed on administrative leave in February and resigned in March. No criminal charges have been filed. Dubuque Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Ted McClyman said the matter remains under investigation. According to the warrant application, Holy Family Director of Finance Bonnie Sigworth and Chief Administrator Philip Warman raised questions about Wessels purchasing unexplained prepaid Visa cards. Wessels maintained that he was using the cards to purchase apps for the district's computers. After Wessels was placed on leave, Sigworth and Borman accessed financial records in Wessels' PayPal account. Sigworth found that Wessels appeared to have used his Holy Family credit card to buy prepaid cards and upload them to his PayPal account, according to the warrant application. In 2019 alone, Wessels uploaded approximately $53,000 to his personal PayPal account, the application reads. Account records showed hundreds of purchases Wessels made for personal items. Borman looked into Wessels' school accounts and learned that Wessels was selling computer and technology equipment online, the application states. The items Wessels was selling were purchased with Holy Family money, and the proceeds were being deposited into Wessels' personal PayPal account, the application states. Dubuque police searched Wessels' home on April 7th, and the warrant return was filed last week in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County. Police seized items such as laptops, virtual reality goggles, tablets, smart home equipment, and musical instruments. Officials from Holy Family declined to comment for this story, saying the investigation is ongoing and the matter is related to personnel. Attempts to reach Wessels last week were unsuccessful. In early March, however, he posted about his resignation on Facebook, quote, "I have come to the decision that those who know me, know my character and what I stand for, will continue to believe in me," he wrote. "To those who don't know me, I hope they are able to keep an open mind and realize there are two sides to every story."
Dubuquer has passion for preservation. Christy Monk recently was recognized for her community service by the American Institute of Architects, Iowa chapter. After moving to Dubuque nearly two decades ago, Christy Monk immersed herself in the history of this city. She loved learning the secrets and stories of the many homes and buildings erected during the turn of the 20th century, and by joining the Dubuque Historic Preservation Commission, she was able to lend her knowledge of the landmarks in the area to others. "I'm very impressed with their historic properties and what they are trying to preserve with the commission, Monk said, "It has been a really good learning experience, and I use my knowledge to make myself seem more approachable to people. I can talk about the masonry and water intrusion at a level people understand." Monk, 40, who works at FEH Design in Dubuque as a principal architect, was recently recognized for her service to the community of Dubuque by the American Institute of Architects Iowa chapter. Kevin Iperl, the vice president of the company, said he has worked with Monk for about 15 years. In that time, he has seen her become more and more involved in the city. Monk serves on the Historic Preservation Commission Board and is president of Carnegie Stout Public Library's Board of Trustees. She spends a lot of her spare time serving the community, Iperl said. She's very well organized and is a very good member to some of her younger staff, and she has also encouraged younger architects to take on larger roles. Iperl said Monk has been a part of the creation of popular projects in the city, such as the Multicultural Family Center, the Dubuque Veterans Affairs Outpatient Clinic, and the new Dubuque County facility at 1225 Seipel Road. Monk said she uses knowledge of historical properties and role on the Historic Preservation Board to educate people on the value of each building as she guides them through the proper way to restore buildings. "One of the roles of the commission is education," she said. "If someone wants to make modifications to their historic structure, they need to follow the local guidelines." Currently, Monk is restoring her own historic home, built in 1911. She's passionate about using her knowledge to find ways to better the community and neighborhood. "Our goal is to improve some of the historic buildings stock around Dubuque," she said. "I think it's an exciting time in Dubuque. We have cool buildings, and it's exciting. People want to use them."
Teen charged in Dubuque shooting enters plea. Emmanuel J. Fontaine, 17, pleads guilty to lesser offenses after being charged with attempted murder in 2019 incident. A Dubuque teen charged with attempted murder recently pleaded guilty to lesser charges. Emmanuel J. Fontaine, Jr., 17, of 2017 University Avenue, Apartment 3, pleaded guilty in the Iowa District Court of Dubuque County to charges of going armed with intent and intimidation with a dangerous weapon. And his attorney, public defender Thomas Goodman, abandoned his motion to move the case to juvenile court. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for June 29th. Fontaine faces up to 15 years in prison and fines of $1,750 to $17,500. He is requesting a deferred judgment and civil penalties of $750 and $1,000, according to court filings. With a deferred judgment, if probation and payment obligations are successfully completed, the record of the case is expunged. Fontaine was arrested in late January in connection to a May 13, 2019 shooting near East 18th and White Streets. He also faces charges of possessing the drug ecstasy when he was arrested. Police said Fontaine, then 16 years old, and his brother Jamar D.M. Little, then 17, walked into an alleyway to confront a 15-year-old boy. They allegedly fired three shots at the teen, who escaped unharmed. According to court documents, Fontaine says he was with Little, who carried and shot a .22 caliber gun at or toward Josiah Bogovich. Fontaine and Little then ran to a car driven by their mother, Shianata E. Fontaine, 34, of 2017 University Avenue, Apartment 3, who drove the teens back to her home, according to court documents. In June, Little was charged with attempted murder. In September, he pleaded guilty to going armed with intent and intimidation with a dangerous weapon as part of a plea deal. He was sentenced to probation. Shianta Fontaine has been charged with being an accessory after the fact. She has pleaded not guilty, and her next hearing is set for August 13.
News in brief. 11 more COVID-19 cases, another death in Dubuque County. One day after setting a single-day record for new confirmed COVID-19 cases, Dubuque County on Sunday had its second highest total yet, 11 cases. On Saturday, 16 new cases were reported. The county's total now stands at 136. Additionally, the death of another person with COVID-19 in Dubuque County was reported Sunday. The person was between 61 and 80 years old. That is the fifth related death reported in the county. Four of those have been people aged 61 to 80, while one was between 41 and 60. One more case was reported Sunday in Jackson County, its first new one since April 20th. The county now has had six cases. With no new cases, Jones County remained at 24 and Delaware County at 5. The latest figures for Clayton County are unclear. On Sunday, the state said there were 15 confirmed cases in the county, but it reported there were 17 on Friday and 18 on Saturday. Attempts to clarify those numbers were not successful. Statewide, there were 528 more cases announced. The state's total now stands at 9,169. Nine more deaths, including the one in Dubuque County, were reported, pushing the total to 184. In Wisconsin, there were 304 new confirmed cases, raising the state's total to 7,964. And five new deaths, pushing the total to 339. For the first time since April 14, no new cases were reported in Grant County, which has had 48 cases and six deaths. Two new cases were reported in Crawford County, which now sits at six total. With no new cases, Iowa County stands at seven total and Lafayette County six. In Illinois, 2,994 more cases were announced. The state total now sits at 61,499. 59 total deaths were reported. The total now stands at 2,618 with no new cases. Joe Davis County's total remains at 13.
You are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped. Your reader is Judy
and Helen.
If you have any comments on this or any IRIS program, please call 243-6833 or toll free at 877-404-4747. And don't forget, this and many other IRIS programs are available from our website at iowaradioreading.org. Now we return to the Telegraph Herald.
Dubuque still weighing summer leisure programming. Dubuque Leisure Services recently announced that it continues to review options for summer programs and services amid the uncertainty created by the COVID-19 pandemic. While there are many unknowns, it is certain that the city will not be able to offer as many programs and services as usual, said Recreation Division Manager Dan Kroger in a press release. The department recently conducted a community survey that garnered nearly 800 responses. Respondents weighed in on their feelings about summer programs and services, and if and when they would consider recreational activities outside of their immediate family or household members, the release states. City staff members will consider their responses while making decisions. All programs and services are being evaluated with the safety of both staff and participants as a top priority, the press release states. Other considerations include resource prioritization, equity, staffing levels, sanitation practices, and avoiding the creation of an additional financial burden on taxpayers. Staff aims to have summer activities procedure created and shared online in mid-May, with programming tentatively slated to start on June 15th.
Community members help each other in pandemic, by Scott Reeder. Riverton, Illinois, I stood in line at Dollar General and couldn't help but notice the fellow ahead of me in line was buying 12-gallon jugs of milk. First thing that ran through my mind is, he's part of the problem. He's hoarding food supplies. A few weeks before, I had to drive to 9 Springfield area stores to find a gallon of milk for my family. So a fellow buying 12 gallons didn't sit well with me. I even made a snide comment to the cashier after the fellow left. She set me straight. The cashier explained, when this crisis started, he created his own food bank. He pays for the milk out of his own pocket and delivers it to the doors of people in need. We should never prejudge someone. I'd soured a bit on human nature earlier that same day when I took one of my daughters to the doctor for a skin infection. Our family practitioner, whom we know from church, shared that she can no longer keep surgical masks and gloves in her exam rooms because patients keep stealing boxes of them since the pandemic began. Who would steal protection from healthcare professionals during a pandemic? The great UCLA basketball coach John Wooden once said, "Sports doesn't build character, it reveals it." The great UCLA basketball coach John Wooden once said, "Sports doesn't build character, it reveals it." I think that can also be said of how people act during times of crisis. Some people choose to steal from doctors and nurses while others try to feed a community. I was left wondering, who is this guy who is trying to feed a village? Riverton and its city's sister city, Spalding, have a population of about 4,000. It's a working class town where 58% of the children in school are receiving free or reduced cost lunches, the highest percentage of any school district in Sangamon County. This town is about 5 miles from Springfield. Having lived in the community for nearly 15 years, I can say it has a generous spirit. When Hurricane Harvey hit the Texas Gulf Coast in 2017, individuals filled 2 semi-tractor trailers with donated food, diapers, and other critically needed supplies. That effort was led by Jeb Brown. To look at him, he seems an ordinary working Joe. He drives an old truck and tools around town in blue jeans, a t-shirt, and a baseball cap. A Rockefeller, he is not. But he's found a way to funnel tens of thousands of dollars in food to hungry folks in Riverton since the COVID-19 crisis began in March. Every day we feed 70 to 100 families, and the really cool thing is about the same number of people donate to us. That's what keeps us going, Brown said. Food donations also come in the form of in-kind donations from some Springfield area charities. Brown said he personally purchases all the milk that is given away. To handle the donations, 15 Rivertown residents formed a Kiwanis Club. When folks make a donation, they make out the check to the Kiwanis Club. Not to me, said Brown, who is the club's first president. There are a lot of people in need, hairstylists, waitresses, and others who never had food security issues before. Because pride is a factor that deters some from taking assistance, Brown said they have placed a blessing box in the parking lot of the local high school. This allows people to accept the donations without being seen by their neighbors. We really haven't had much of a problem with people abusing this. They just drive up, take what they need from the box, and drive away, he said. For folks fearful of leaving their homes, Brown said, he delivers food to their doors. Just how many dollars of food has the Kiwanis Club given away since the COVID-19 crisis began? Brown said it's hard to say because much of what they receive is in the form of in-kind contributions, but he placed a figure at over $100,000. So what motivates a person to help? Brown put it this way, Riverton has been good to my family, and now I want to do something good for Riverton.
Vintage cars cruise Dubuque. The postponement of an annual car festival did not deter auto enthusiasts from rolling down their windows and popping the tops as they rumbled through Dubuque on Sunday. The Cruise Dubuque event attracted drivers of more than 225 hot rod and vintage vehicles, along with a smattering of motorcycles, dragsters, and luxury convertibles from across the tri-state region. Participants who gathered at the Dubuque County Fairgrounds took advantage of the sunny skies not only to get out and enjoy the weather, but also to kindle nostalgia for seniors as they drove past assisted living and skilled nursing facilities along the route. Those people are locked down, said event organizer John Wells of Bettendorf, Iowa. This is a way to bring something to them and let them see those old classic cars rolling by. Cruise Dubuque occurred in lieu of annual Vintage Torque Fest, which was postponed to July 3rd to 5th because of the COVID-19 restrictions and concerns. Well said, the idea for the new event emerged from discussions with participants in Travel Dubuque. We had a lot of people privately emailing and said they were going to go to the fairgrounds and cruise around Dubuque anyway, he said. There are a lot of people that are going to be itching to get their cars out. Normally, Torque Fest includes a cruise from the fairgrounds to Galena, Illinois, so hosting a cruise was a natural fit that would bring joy to viewers. I think we might have drove some of them, said Bernice Martinson, 81, laughing. She sat with her husband, Benny Martinson, outside Oak Park Place, waiting for more cars to pass through the senior living complex's driveway. Benny was particularly impressed with a rose and white 1956 Chevrolet Bel Air, which reminded him of his own 1958 model. Later, drivers traveled to Veterans Memorial Park, followed by a downtown cruise that consisted of a loop along Loris Boulevard and Bluff, First and Locust Streets. Dubuque resident Chuck Sorka sat inside his 1931 Ford Model A, one of 13 vintage cars the retired farmer owns. He can't keep them straight, joked his wife, Colleen Sorka, from the passenger seat. Chuck said the vehicles remind him of his childhood when he would play inside those that had been discarded in farm fields. Scrap metal wasn't worth much back then. Mark Van Epps also drove a Model A, but his vehicle boasted a boogie board on the roof and an American flag lazily flapping in the breeze. Although the car looks unfinished, the Dodgeville, Wisconsin auto mechanic actually painted it to look aged. He and his two buddies restored the vehicle about 6 years ago after Van Epps, while deer hunting, discovered it abandoned in the woods. The roof is gone and the sides had folded in. You had to have an imagination to ever think it would be a car again, he said. It was worth saving.
Online meetings set for transmission line. 350-mile SOO Green HVDC link would pass through Dubuque, Bellevue, and Guttenberg. A series of public meetings detailing a planned transmission line project that will pass through several tri-state communities has been rescheduled for this week. Postponed in March, the meetings now planned for May 5th and 8th will allow for residents to ask about the SOO Green HVDC link transmission line project, which will cross through Dubuque, Bellevue, and Guttenberg, Iowa. Sarah Lucan, spokesperson for the project, said the public meetings will allow residents to ask questions on the project and how it will be implemented. The meetings are required to be held in order for the project to be approved by the Iowa Utilities Board. It will be dedicated to answering questions, Lucan said. We want to be able to have a discussion with landowners and neighbors. The 350-mile high voltage underground transmission line will extend from Mason City, Iowa to Chicago with the intention of delivering renewable energy created in Iowa to the eastern United States. The 2,100-watt line is anticipated to power about 1.2 million homes. Iowa is a leader in renewable energy, Lucan said. We want to take those assets and send them across the country. A $2.7 billion initiative, the underground line will be installed along the right-of-way of operating railroad, including Canadian Pacific Railroad, that runs through Guttenberg, Dubuque, and Bellevue. Jesse Harris, spokesperson for the project, said the construction plans are still in their early phases, but plans include working with local city governments to ensure minimal disruption to residents when the line is being installed in their respective communities. While the majority of the project should have minimal impact on the daily lives of residents, Harris said a few parts of the project will intersect with roads and public utilities. In those cases, we will work with local officials to identify alternative routes for traffic or implement alternate construction techniques that will not disrupt the surface as needed, Harris said. In Bellevue, the railroad runs directly through the city. Abby Scriveseth, Bellevue City Administrator, said she has little information from officials with the transmission line project on how resident disruptions will be mitigated. The city has not even seen a copy of their proposed franchise agreement to use city property to put the infrastructure in through town, Scrivseth said. They plan to get something done soon, but this COVID-19 has put a delay on everything. When reached by the Telegraph Herald, Randy Gale, public information officer for Dubuque, directed questions regarding the impact the project will have on Dubuque residents to Harris. Harris said the project will have a significant positive economic impact on the communities it will pass through, primarily through the hiring of local construction contractors and workers. We anticipate it will create about 12,000 jobs in construction, Harris said. Lucan said construction is anticipated to start in 2021 and be completed by 2024. She could not provide a timeline for when construction might begin in the tri-state area.
Coronavirus creates new worries for people with disabilities. From Raleigh, North Carolina, the coronavirus pandemic has forced hard choices on people with disabilities who live independently with the help of workers who come into their homes. Social distancing isn't an option. Workers, called direct support professionals, have duties that it can include lifting clients into wheelchairs, making their meals, and helping them dress, along with keeping them connected to the outside world in their homes. Medicaid, the government insurance program, pays for in-home services for thousands of people with disabilities. People with disabilities generally experience greater risk because they are more likely to rely on other people to meet their basic needs. With the spread of the highly infectious coronavirus, some people who are living independently have returned to live with family members. Others continue to receive in-home services, but the coronavirus has made them and their support workers cautious. It's kind of nerve-wracking to hear all this stuff about social distance because you can't have a personal care attendant if you have to keep 6 feet away, Brian Dooley, 29, said through an interpreter. That did make me nervous. Dooley, who lives in Louisville, Forsyth County, has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair. He receives services through a Medicaid program called Innovations Waiver, which is designed to keep people with disabilities out of institutions. About 13,140 people use the Innovations Waiver, according to the State Department of Health and Human Services. Dooley is a member of the North Carolina Council on Developmental Disabilities and a member of the Disabilities Rights in North Carolina Board of Directors.
We have only one obituary in today's paper. Rita M. Putman, Bellevue, Iowa. Rita Reese Putman, 67, of Bellevue, passed away on Friday, May 1st, 2020, at her home surrounded by her loving family. Complete arrangements are pending at Hockman Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Bellevue. Codfish Hollow asking for donations. Maquoketa, Iowa. Codfish Hollow Barnstormers is asking for donations to help the family-owned and volunteer-staffed barn-turned concert venue stay afloat. The venue has been forced to shut its doors in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. According to its website, its first concert of the season is tentatively set to take place in June. Our goal is to reopen as soon as it is safely possible, co-owner Tiffany Beal wrote on the venue's GoFundMe page. However, we must be honest that this will not be possible without support from the community. Our monthly bills are still due, and although as of right now, the few shows we had scheduled are postponed and not canceled, we still have to pay the bands and the bills. We have no way to make money without people in the barn. Alcohol, merchandise, and ticket sales are our only sources of revenue. To donate, visit www.gofundme.com and help Codfish Hollow.
Onward cancels May 17th show from Maquoketa, Iowa. Absolutely Country, Definitely Gospel, scheduled for 2 p.m. Sunday, May 17th at Onward Fine Arts Center, has been canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Those who have purchased tickets can contact the Center for Ticket Exchange to any upcoming show at the venue.
Online caregiving training to begin May 18th. Iowa State University Extension and Outreach will host an online powerful tools for caregivers class leader training Monday to Friday, May 18th to the 22nd. The virtual integrated training will equip class leaders to co-lead programs for caregivers of adults with chronic conditions and caregivers of children with special health and behavioral needs. Powerful Tools for Caregivers is a program for caregivers of children with special health and behavioral needs for those who provide care for a spouse, parent, or friend with a chronic condition such as dementia or Alzheimer's disease. The program aims to provide information, support, strategies, communication techniques, stress reduction ideas, and resources to assist family caregivers with their concerns related to caregiving. Those interested can access the registration link at bit.ly/PTC13845. For more information, email Human Sciences Specialist Melissa Radar and Barb Dunn Swanson at PTC Master Trainers@iastate.edu.
News in brief. Police: Dubuque man threatened to kill mom with a hammer. Police said a Dubuque man on Saturday threatened to kill his mother with a hammer he was holding, with which he also broke a window. Corey M. Jones, 22 of 2301 White Street, was arrested at about 6:35 p.m. Saturday at his residence on charges of domestic assault while displaying or using a weapon and first-degree harassment. His next court hearing is set for June 2nd. Court documents state that officers responded to Jones' residence Saturday after his aunt Jolene A. Hines, 45 of Bernard, Iowa, received a text message from her sister Tara D. Jones, 49, who is Cora Jones' mother and had been staying with him. The text message said, "Cora told me he was going to hit me in the head with a hammer and kill me while holding the tool." Tara Jones offered the same recounting of events when interviewed by police. Austin L. Jones, 24, who also lives at the White Street address, said there had been an argument between Tara and Corey and that Corey hit the door with a hammer, documents state. Police said the glass on the door was broken out. Documents state that Cora Jones admitted to having had the hammer but said he was fixing the door.
One injured in a motorcycle crash near Darlington, Wisconsin. A man was injured Saturday in a motorcycle crash near Darlington. David C. Anderson, 48, of Mineral Point, was taken by ambulance to a local hospital for treatment of non-life-threatening injuries, according to the Lafayette County Sheriff's Department. The crash occurred at about 4:55 p.m. Saturday on Furnace Hill Road. A press release states that Anderson was southbound when he lost control of his motorcycle on a curve and left the road and went into a ditch.
Draft key to Saints development philosophy. Lack of trades means Dubuque has all its picks in both phases of the draft. Callie Larson prefers to develop the Dubuque Fighting Saints roster from within, so the next 2 days will be paramount to the future of the United States Hockey League organization. Larson will oversee the Saints draft for the fifth straight year. Phase 1 begins at 3 p.m. today and includes 10 rounds of players only born in 2004, while Phase 1 opens at 1 p.m. Tuesday, including all junior-eligible players, and runs until each team has 45 players on its protected list. "We take a lot of pride in trying to stick with our guys," said Larson, who joined the Saints as Director of Player Personnel in August 2015 and earned a promotion to General Manager 2 years later. "Sometimes that's not possible because you don't do as well in the draft process as you'd like. But if we can stick with the guys we draft, we certainly prefer to do that." Dubuque's recent rosters certainly reflect that philosophy. In the past 3 years, the Saints have acquired only one player from another USHL team with an in-season move. They landed Youngstown's Dalton Hunter off waivers early in the 17-18 season. This season, the Saints used a league-low 28 players, including three affiliates list players. The league average was 38.5, and 7 teams used 40 or more players. Colley has done a remarkable job of really establishing an assembly line, so to speak, here in Dubuque, Saints coach Oliver David said. He's built our organizational depth chart and the affiliates list so well. We don't have to go out and make a lot of trades to build our team. Instead, we can address a lot of our needs from within, and I expect that to be the case again this year. The Saints will return as many as 10 players from a team that went 33-13-2 and finished second overall in the USHL, but they will graduate their top 10 five scorers, key defenseman and USHL goalie of the year, Eric Portillo. The returners includes a solid 1-2 goal-ending punch in veteran Aiden McCarthy and affiliates list standout Hobie Henquist.
Memorable diamond shines brightly again. Holy Ghost's Weirich Field brought back to its former glory by Tim O'Neill. The search was frantic, with the Dubuque Miracle League project at Veterans Memorial Park leading to the removal of two public diamonds. The Dubuque Thunder softball organization was suddenly left without a home. Josh Moore, who along with his wife Ashley runs the Thunder, spent countless hours in his car a couple of years ago scouring Dubuque for an open field that could serve as the practice base for their group of six travel softball teams ranging from 8U to 14U. With the immediate future of 75 players hanging in the balance, the Moores threw a Hail Mary. The Moore's last option, Josh said, would have been to purchase an empty lot and start from scratch. We were just trying to keep the kids on our mind, he said. We wanted to make sure we weren't telling 75 kids that they didn't have a team anymore. After visiting one of his old boyhood diamonds, the Thunder had a prospective home. Tucked up on a hill behind Holy Ghost Catholic Church, Weirich Field lay vacant and overgrown with weeds for years. Recently sold to the Shriver family, Josh Moore struck a deal with the Shrivers to transform the unused portion of the field and keep the Thunder alive. When they decided to transition that space at Vets into the Miracle Field, we were at a bit of a loss as to where to practice at, Ashley Moore said. Josh basically drove around town for several days trying to find some open space and ended up finding this. Sean and Corin Shriver had recently purchased the property from Holy Ghost and began using the plot for urban farming. Half of the lot was unused, though it was still part of the Shrivers' future plans. The Moores pitched a partnership to the Shrivers. A deal was reached with the Thunder organization renting the field. When they talked to us about their needs, it seemed like fate, kind of a perfect mix, Corin Shriver said. That way it wouldn't have to go unused and they would have a home. Dedicated in honor of Father William J. Weirich, the Holy Ghost pastor from 1905 to 31, the athletic field once was used for many purposes, including the Dubuque Independent League and youth baseball and softball tournaments. Since we bought it, it's been interesting how many stories we've heard about it. Oh yeah, I played softball up there, or my kids played football up there, Corin Shriver said. It's been really fun to hear the stories people have told us. Not even just softball and football, but people that played up here went sledding down the hill. There have been a lot of cool stories. Now, though, many years after the last champion was crowned, overgrown weeds had rendered the field unrecognizable. There were some that were 6 foot, Josh said. Basically, the dugouts were completely overgrown. There were no dugouts. It was there, but you couldn't tell it was there, Ashley said. We literally had no idea there was a walkway, no idea there were actual dugouts until we got everything cut back and trimmed down. An army of Thunder volunteers converged at the site, and over a couple of long weekends, the feral parcel had been tamed, with two diamonds cut into the grass and more than 3 tons of limestone hauled in for the infield surfaces. We were fortunate to have a lot of parents and coaches who helped us out, who have different trades that were able to bring down dump trucks and skid steers, Ashley Moore said. It was a lot of work, but ultimately it's a home for 75 girls that are able to continue playing softball. The Thunder are now in their second season using the field, which is only used for practices and is not suitable for games or tournaments. For the girls in the organization, the field offers a chance to make new memories. And for those who played there in its former times, it offers a look back. It was a neat experience. It definitely brought back memories from playing up there, Josh Moore said. The cool thing was seeing everybody else's reaction via Facebook after the transformation. I don't know how many Facebook messages we've had after showing all the pictures, but there were hundreds of messages and people we didn't even know saying, "Oh yeah, I used to play up there," or "I used to go up there and watch my daughter play up there." That was the cool part. And this brings us to the end of today's reading of the Telegraph Herald for Monday, May 4th. I'm your reader, Judy.
And Helen.
Support for this reading comes from the DuPaco R.W. Heffer Foundation. The Telegraph Herald can be heard each weekday at 2 p.m. All programs heard on IRIS are intended solely for the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions or comments on this or any IRIS program, please call our office toll-free at 877-404-4747. Thanks for listening.